Ever noticed how often adultery is, well, played for laughs? You see it in movies, TV shows, even way back in things like the Canterbury Tales.
Oh, absolutely. The poor cuckolded husband, he's often the punchline, isn't he?
Exactly. It feels almost normalized sometimes in our stories today, rarely shown as the, you know, profound tragedy it once was.
It's such a striking contrast, because if you go back way back to ancient societies, think the ancient Near East, including early Israel, adultery was viewed with, well, absolute horror.
Horror meaning?
Meaning the prescribed penalty, and this is for both people involved, was often death, usually by stoning.
Wow. That's hard to even wrap your head around today, considering how lightly it's sometimes treated now.
It really is. And that huge difference, that's exactly what we want to dig into today.
Right. Our mission here is to explore why. Why did this massive shift of understanding happen? How did the definition itself change so radically over time? And crucially, what did Jesus's teachings add to this ancient commandment?
You know, let's unpack that. Because to get the shift, you first have to understand the starting point. Marriage in the ancient Near East, we're talking broadly about, you know, the region of modern Iraq, Syria, Israel. It was fundamentally different from our modern ideal.
Different how? We think romance, soulmates.
Right. And while, sure, love poems existed, we have beautiful ones like the Song of Solomon. Romance just wasn't the primary basis for marriage. Not usually.
That's really counterintuitive for us today. So if it wasn't primarily about romance, what was it about?
It was essentially a contractual agreement, often arranged by the fathers, actually.
A contract for what?
The main goal, ensuring the proper transfer of family property from one generation to the next.
Ah, property. Okay.
Exactly. Producing legitimate children was absolutely crucial for inheritance. It was even seen as a kind of immortality, I suppose. Being remembered through your descendants, especially when ideas about the afterlife were still, you know, developing.
It makes sense, like securing the family line.
Precisely. You even see this mindset much later, right? Think of Henry VIII and his desperate struggle for a male heir. It wasn't really about finding true love. It was about succession, power, property. That's the ancient mindset carrying through.
Okay, so if marriage is basically a property contract, how did adultery fit into that? What actually counted as breaking the rules?
Well, in that specific context, adultery was defined very, very clearly.
Yeah.
It was a man having sexual relations with a married woman, or, importantly, a betrothed woman.
Just a married or betrothed woman.
Yes. And here's the crucial bit. It generally was not considered adultery for a man, even a married man, to, say, frequent prostitutes.
Really?
Yeah. Or to have relations with unattached women, though, you know, that might have other social consequences. Or even to keep a mistress or a concubine. None of that typically fell under the legal definition of adultery for the man.
Okay, hold on. A concubine, what exactly was that status?
Good question. A concubine was sort of like a second-class wife. She'd get a home, she could have children, but those kids usually couldn't expect to inherit property. And she didn't have the same legal protections as a wife from a full marriage contract.
So, like, wife light?
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
A companion, a sexual partner, but without the full legal standing. So, a married man with his concubine, or a prostitute. Not technically an adulterer under those ancient laws.
Okay. But for what was considered adultery, the penalties sound incredibly severe.
No, absolutely brutal. You look at the ancient Near Eastern law codes, like the Middle Assyrian ones, they were obsessed with this. The baseline penalty, usually, death. For both the man and the woman.
Death. Wow.
But what kind of fascinating are the nuances you sometimes see. In Assyria, for example, the husband actually had options. He didn't have to kill his wife.
Oh, like what?
Well, he could choose instead to cut off her nose or her ears.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And crucially, the man she was with got the exact same punishment. Or, another option, the husband could sell his wife into slavery. And again, the man involved was also sold into slavery.
So there's this strange sort of transactional fairness, like an eye for an eye, almost literally.
Exactly. It still reflects that property aspect, doesn't it? Damage done, damage paid.
So given that background in the wider region, how did ancient Israel fit in? Were their views pretty much the same?
Strikingly similar, actually. The Israelite understanding of marriage you see in the Old Testament very much aligned with their neighbors, primarily focused on producing children for inheritance.
Kids and property again.
Kids and property. Now, of course, you have beautiful exceptions. Think of Hannah's story and Samuel. Her husband, Elkanah, clearly loves her deeply, maybe even more than potential sons. But broadly speaking, marriages were arranged by families, often for property transfer.
And you see things like bride prices.
You do.
Yeah.
Like King David needing, what was it, 100 Philistine foreskins to marry Saul's daughter. That was a bride price. And dowries, too, which were actually the woman's protection, financially, if a divorce happened.
So prenups aren't exactly new, then?
Huh. Not at all. Prenuptial agreements were surprisingly common, it seems.
Okay, so this idea of marriage as a legacy contract was deeply embedded. What about betrothal, then? You mentioned that earlier. Was violating that just as serious?
Absolutely. Betrothal was incredibly serious business. Breaking a betrothal agreement through infidelity was treated exactly like adultery.
Like the Mary and Joseph story.
That's the classic example, right?
Yeah.
Mary is betrothed to Joseph, then found to be pregnant. Under the Old Testament law of the time, Joseph legally had the right, maybe even the obligation, to have her stoned to death for adultery.
Which makes his decision.
An incredible act of virtue, yeah. Choosing instead to divorce her quietly, to protect her. It shows the weight of that law.
And polygamy, we hear about figures like David and Solomon having many wives. How did that work in this contractual view?
Well, polygamy was definitely permitted in the Old Testament. But it wasn't generally seen as the ideal. The ideal, right from Genesis 2, seems pretty clearly one man, one woman for life.
So why was it allowed then?
It was often a sign of wealth, for one thing. Supporting multiple households was expensive. And, you know, from a maybe less cynical perspective, in those ancient societies, I think lots of warfare, shorter male lifespans, there were often many widows and many unattached women.
Right. Practical realities.
Yeah. So for some women, maybe being wife number 4 or 5 to a wealthy man offered more security than facing destitution or, well, prostitution. It wasn't always just about male desire. Sometimes it was about survival and status.
What about ending the contract? Divorce. Could men just, you know, ditch their wives easily?
Well, the law said a man could divorce his wife for indecency. But what that meant, oh, boy, that was a huge debate among the rabbis, the Jewish legal scholars, especially around Jesus' time.
A debate? How so?
You had these two major schools of thought, one led by Rabbi Hillel, who argued indecency, really meant only serious sexual misconduct, basically adultery.
Okay, a stricter view.
And then you had Rabbi Shammai, who famously argued it could mean almost anything the husband found displeasing, even if she just burned his dinner.
Burnt dinner, seriously.
That was his position. Mm-hmm. But interestingly, we found texts from the Persian period, showing that women divorcing their husbands wasn't actually that uncommon either. Those prenuptial agreements we mentioned, they often facilitated it. So in some ways, it was surprisingly modern.
It still sounds like, legally speaking, there was a pretty clear double standard in the Old Testament law regarding adultery itself, right? Men had more wiggle room.
Legally, yes. That seems fair to say. The letter of the law defined adultery primarily around the married woman. A married woman with someone, not her husband. Adultery? A man, married or not, with a married woman. Adultery. But a man, even a married one, with prostitutes or unmarried mistresses. Legally, not adultery.
But that wasn't the whole story.
No, because this is where the prophets step in. They offer this higher divine perspective. Figures like Hosea, Jeremiah, Ezekiel. They constantly use the language of adultery to describe Israel's unfaithfulness to God through idolatry.
Ah, so using it metaphorically.
Yes, but it reveals God's ideal. God says explicitly through Hosea, essentially, don't expect me to punish your wives for adultery when you men are doing the same thing with temple prostitutes. It's a clear condemnation of the double standard. God's ideal didn't include one, even if the human laws of the time allowed it.
Okay, so even with those prophetic critiques, the official punishment written down was still death by stoning. Did that actually happen much?
That's a really crucial point. While death by stoning was the prescribed penalty in the Torah, the Old Testament law, there's quite a bit of evidence suggesting it was rarely carried out in actual practice.
Like what?
Well, think about Hosea himself. His wife, Gomer, was repeatedly unfaithful. Did he stone her? No. His plan was actually to buy her back, essentially out of slavery or a bad situation.
Right, and King David.
The most famous example. David commits adultery with Bathsheba, then arranges for her husband's murder. Huge sins. Was he stoned? No. He faced consequences, terrible ones for his family, but not execution by stoning.
So the law was more of an ideal or a deterrent.
Perhaps. Mm-hmm. It seems ancient adultery laws were primarily focused on protecting the family legacy and property. You know, the cuckoo in the nest problem, ensuring only legitimate heirs inherited the family wealth and name. The law codes might have functioned more as guidelines for judges, setting a high standard, but allowing for, well, a lot more practical grace and nuance than maybe later stricter interpretations, like those of the Pharisees, would allow.
Okay, so that sets the scene for Jesus's time. You have these laws, maybe not always strictly enforced, perhaps even treated lightly. You mentioned Herod strangling his wife, Mary Amineri, on suspicion, not stoning her.
Exactly. The legal framework existed, but practice could be inconsistent.
And then we get to this really pivotal story, don't we? The woman caught in adultery in John chapter 8. This feels like a turning point.
It's profoundly insightful. It really shows Jesus starting this redefinition. The Pharisees drag this woman before him. They say she was caught in the very act. Red flag right there, probably a setup.
How so?
Well, where's the man? Adultery involves two people. Anyway, they say the law of Moses says she should be stoned. What do you say?
It's a trap, isn't it?
Absolutely, a calculated trap. If he says don't stone her, he's contradicting Moses' law. If he says stone her, he's endorsing an execution that was probably rare and might even have required Roman approval, which they likely didn't have. He'd be caught either way.
So what does he do?
He doesn't play their game. He pauses, doodles in the dirt, and then delivers that incredible line. All right, let the one among you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her.
Wow. Turning it right back on them.
Completely. It challenges the letter of the law. It challenges the likely common practice of maybe not stoning people. And most importantly, it shifts the focus entirely onto the accuser's own moral state. And by implication, onto everyone's moral state.
That is powerful. But he takes it even further, doesn't he? He starts to redefine marriage itself, going beyond Moses and those rabbinic squabbles.
He does. Look at Matthew chapter 19. They ask him about divorce, trying to trap him in that Hillel versus Shammai debate. Does he pick a side? Nope.
What does he do instead?
He goes right back past Moses, past the debates, all the way back to the beginning, to Genesis. Haven't you read, he says, that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female? For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh.
So he's pointing to the original ideal.
Yeah, exactly. He says Moses permitted divorce only because people's hearts were hard. It wasn't God's original intention or design. And this is the crucial shift. Jesus redefines adultery, not primarily as a disruption of property transfer, but as the breakdown of the marriage relationship itself. It's about undermining that one flesh union.
So marriage becomes about the relationship, the union, not the contract.
Precisely. For Jesus, it's fundamentally about the relational bond, the becoming one, not property or legalities.
And this redefinition, it really culminates in that statement in Matthew chapter 5, doesn't it? The one about adultery of the heart. That feels like the most radical part.
It truly is revolutionary. Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully hath already committed adultery with her in his heart."
From the physical act right into the mind, the heart.
Exactly. He moves the entire issue from external actions, which the rabbis obsessed over, you know, defining exactly what counted. Even weird hypotheticals like a man falling off a roof naked onto a sunbathing woman, does that count?
Seriously, they debated that.
Apparently. But Jesus just bypasses all that. He goes to the internal state. The heart, which in ancient Hebrew thought wasn't just about emotion, it was the seat of the will, of intention.
So when he says looks lustfully, what does that actually mean? Is it just finding someone attractive, a passing thought?
That's a key question. My old seminary professor explained it really well. The Greek word here, epithumio, it's not just a fleeting glance or noticing beauty. It's more like a burning desire to possess. It's an infatuation that engages your will. Engages your will. How so? It means you're not just noticing. You're actively entertaining the thought, cultivating it, letting it become an obsession. You're starting to will the breakdown of the relationship, even if only internally. It's an internal act of infidelity.
I see. Like that Jimmy Carter anecdote where he admitted to lust in his heart. People focus on the physical line, but Jesus puts it way earlier.
Exactly. Carter was wrestling with Jesus' standard, not just the world's. Jesus places the line in the heart, the seat of intention. If the will isn't involved like that, hypothetical hypnotized man forced into something, there's no actual adultery in Jesus' sense. The issue isn't just the final action, but the whole thought process, the desire that leads towards it.
Okay, so if the battle starts in the heart, in the will, what does Jesus tell us to do about it? He says some pretty intense things, like plucking out eyes and cutting off hands.
Yeah, that's obviously hyperbole, right? He's not suggesting literal self-mutilation.
Okay, good. So what's the point?
His point is about radical willingness. We need to be willing to make drastic sacrifices, to maintain purity, to protect the integrity of our relationships, whatever it takes.
Radical sacrifices like?
Well, in modern terms. Maybe means giving up certain websites or types of media that you know are a trigger for you. being ruthless about cutting off sources of temptation.
Are there real-world examples of this kind of thinking?
There are. You hear stories, maybe apocryphal, maybe not. There was that dentist in Iowa a few years back who fired his assistant because he found her too attractive, said it was a danger to his marriage. The courts actually upheld his decision, interestingly.
Oh, wow.
And back in 2010, there was a pastor who reportedly required his whole ministry staff to delete their Facebook accounts because some were reconnecting with old flames and it was causing problems.
That's pretty extreme.
It sounds extreme, but it illustrates the principle Jesus is teaching. If something, anything, is causing you to stumble or threatening your most important commitments, be willing to make a radical cut. Get rid of it to protect what truly matters.
And this idea of adultery, it even gets broadened out beyond marriage in the New Testament, right?
That's right. The Apostle James talks about spiritual adultery. He writes, "You adulterous people, don't you know that friendship with the world means enmity against God?"
So being too attached to worldly values is like cheating on God?
That's exactly the idea. Just like the Old Testament prophets called Israel's idolatry adultery against God, James uses the same concept. It reinforces that for the New Testament writers following Jesus, this is fundamentally about purity of heart, mind, devotion, whether to your spouse or to God, not just avoiding specific physical acts. The standard is internal.
Which brings us to that quote, I think it's often attributed to Martin Luther, something about birds.
Ah, yes, the Luther quote. "You cannot stop the birds from flying over your head, but you don't have to let them build nests in your hair."
I like that. What's the takeaway there?
It perfectly captures the reality of temptation, doesn't it? We're human. Stray thoughts, fleeting attractions might happen. As someone said, God doesn't give you a lobotomy when you get married. The birds of temptation might fly by.
Right.
But Luther's point, and it's Jesus's point too, really, is that you have a choice. You don't have to invite those thoughts in, feed them, let them settle down, and build a nest. You don't have to let them become obsessions.
So you can choose not to dwell on them.
Exactly. You can put the brakes on, change the channel, literally or metaphorically, go for a walk, call a friend, pray, focus on something else. The key is recognizing those initial thoughts. And crucially, maybe being vulnerable enough to talk about struggles with trusted friends or mentors.
Yeah.
Because secrecy is where those nests often get built.
Nip it in the bud, basically.
Nip it in the bud. Strive for that purity from the inside out. You're not alone in it, and there are healthy ways to manage it.
It's just fascinating to trace that evolution from adultery as essentially a property crime in the ancient world.
Yeah, focused on inheritance and lineage.
Through this legal ideal in the Old Testament, which maybe had more practical grace than we assume.
Right, rarely resulting in the harshest penalty.
All the way to Jesus's really radical redefinition, centered completely on the relationship itself, the integrity of that one flesh union, and the purity of the heart, the will, the intentions.
It's a massive shift, isn't it? From focusing almost entirely on external acts to understanding the critical importance of the internal reality.
It really makes you think differently. And for you listening, how does this land, given Jesus's emphasis on internal purity, on the profound value he places on the marriage relationship itself, how does that challenge maybe your own understanding of temptation?
Yeah, and what sacrifices might you need to consider making, maybe even radically, to protect the most important relationships in your life? It's worth reflecting on how striving for that kind of purity from the inside out could actually transform your own lived experience.